Now I'll tell you about Dizzy. What do you want to know about Dizzy? How should we start?
I guess because the reason it resonates so much with me is because it's so much, well, besides like the Olympic Games video games. But to one degree or another, we all, you know, if you grew up in the 80s, you played those games on your Commodore 64.
Right.
But Dizzy is such a hyper-local, like, computer game experience that never, like, translated to America. Like, I only knew about Dizzy because what's-his-face on Zero Punctuation would reference Dizzy every once in a while.
Was it him that used to say, like, it's not the greatest game of all time, and every time he said that, he would flash up Fantasy World Dizzy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that was my own... I was like, what is this that I'm missing? What is this reference that's so... it's obviously something people know about, because otherwise he wouldn't use it as a tossed-off joke.
Yeah.
But... So in my mind, I was like, is this the greatest game ever made?
It is.
Like, is that the joke?
I don't know. I don't know whether the joke was that it was or it wasn't, but it was.
I see Dizzy as like kind of, especially in like, the way you reference it and stuff, it's kind of a microcosm of this thing that sort of you grew up with and that means a lot to you, but that then like disappeared but is a huge cultural touchstone for you.
Okay, so to explain what Dizzy is, and by the way, this is very apt. The top trend in the UK on Twitter right now is UK versus US. I've already mentioned that we had computers where America had consoles, and in particular, where America had the NES, we had the ZX Spectrum, and we had it because it was a little computer. Famously, it had rubber keys, but I'm too young for that. It just had normal keyboard by the time I was into it and was, you know, better at running games by that time. It was more powerful by that time. It was a little computer which was involved in a competition run by the government. They said that they would put a computer in every primary school in the UK. And in those days, that meant something. Schools didn't have any computers. But the government would say, no, we're going to put one whole computer in every school. And that genuinely was enough in those days. So a few different computer manufacturers went to work trying to be the computer that got into the schools. And there was a little war, particularly between Sinclair, who made the ZX Spectrum, and Acorn, who made... Oh, I forget what it's called, but it's known as the BBC Micro these days. They battled it out, and the ZX Spectrum lost. And that's why the other one is called the BBC Micro, because it had the BBC, which is, you know, a state broadcaster. They were involved in it, and they you know, it basically just became this... The official computer of the UK was the BBC Micro, and it went into all the schools. And as a result, like... That was the Squares computer. That lost the public opinion vote by winning that competition. And so, you know, some kids did have them, but really the only proprietary thing, the only thing, like piece of software, killer app for that computer that I can think of now was Elite. Everything else was on the ZX Spectrum, and it was cheaper, and it was scrappier, and I described it in my video as being a bit more sort of working class feeling. There was almost a sort of element of class warfare involved in it, because it was cheaper. And the BBC, where everyone speaks like that, that was the BBC Micro. Or you can have the ZX Spectrum. And that was, you know, so that was the one that won out. And that was the one where the games were really cheap and so on and so on. And for a long time, and people made them themselves. There was a real homegrown quality to it, in the same way that, you know, indie games are now, except think more Undertale and less Minecraft, in the sense that they really were literally made by more or less one person and then some of that person's friends who they might bring in. And regularly, it was normal to play games made by a single person, even by a child who made it in their bedroom. That was normal. And two of these children were the Oliver twins. And they were twins. They remain twins today. And they, I think, did code in their bedrooms. Although, you know, they had, like, quite a lot of computers in their bedroom. You know, they were prodigies. They were really good at coding. And they made a couple of games, which they sold to Codemasters, who exist now. They make racing games. But at the time, they were just making any games for this scrappy little home system. The Oliver twins had this idea that the graphics of the computers that were out at the time weren't being pushed all the way. We were making games with a sort of Space Invaders kind of sensibility, where the characters on screen, characters though they were, looked weird, and you kind of had to imagine what they were supposed to be. So, like, I don't know if you ever encountered a Space Invaders machine in the wild, but those, I'm sure you did, but
yes,
those, and correct me if I'm wrong, actually, because I may be imagining or remembering some of this wrong, because I would have been younger, but the sprites that we all know as the Space Invaders, there were drawings of them on the cabinet, but they weren't any more, like, it wasn't like, here's what this is supposed to look like. It was still the weird-shaped, pixelated, weirdy things from the screen.
Yeah, and unlike Pac-Man, which drew a cartoon of Pac-Man, which looked nothing like the Pac-Man on the screen.
They made him into a sort of blobby fish thing, didn't they?
Yeah, he had legs, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and that was, exactly, that was what they did with games in those days. And this is something I go into in my Dave's First Game video. Like, the graphics in a game were only supposed to be symbols, and they were a springboard for the imagination, and you were invited to imagine the thing you're really supposed to be looking at. So, like, and probably the most famous example of this is Adventure, which was a game where you literally were just a pixel going through a maze made up of just lines, and, you know, there was nothing to see.
But it was supposed to be a castle.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, some games would have literal stick men, and you were supposed to just, you read the inlay and it was like, oh, you are this. You're a knight or whatever. And so you imagine a knight. Well, around this time was when people were starting to get the hang of, like, how to push the spectrum and things further to actually represent, you know, characters. Because, you know, we already had, like, arcade games that had quite good graphics. So it wasn't like this was something that was happening on the spectrum. That wasn't ground zero for this.
Right.
But it was starting to emerge there. And the Oliver twins went, well, what if we push that to its greatest extent? And what if we make a game where the gimmick of the game is that it is like what you were thinking about when you played Mario? What if we made the ultimate cartoon adventure and people are playing a cartoon at home? Can we do that? And Dizzy is what they made. And they came about it in such a strange way, because what Dizzy emerged as, he became Europe's Mario. He became, like, he was a very, very big, well-known character in UK gaming particularly, but European gaming. And he's huge in Russia for some reason. And he was an egg. He was a little egg with a face who would go on little adventures. And that was what Dizzy was. And if you look at, you can look up his games now. If you look up, like, Fantasy World Dizzy or Magic Land Dizzy on the Spectrum, do it. Go to YouTube, listeners, and have a little look. And what you will see, you will not recognize as fitting the description of the ultimate cartoon adventure. You'll just see an old game. But at the time, compared to the other games that we had on that system, it really was. It was so new and so different in so many ways, because it's not as if it felt immersive, like, oh, I am literally playing a cartoon. It was a new thing in the way the Rock of Fire Explosion or Chuck E. Cheese was a new thing. It was it had its own atmosphere and its own environment, and you just let your brain go into that place and just be there. And, like, it's difficult to explain, and I'll nail it down when I make a video about this, but, like, it was a whole new experience. So the way you play the game, you're this little egg. And by the way, the reason he's an egg is just because they didn't think it through. So when they were like, oh, let's design the ultimate cartoon character for the Spectrum, they just drew a little circle, a little egg shape to be his face. And they put a face on it. And then they just sort of gave up there. So
right. And it does look like a circle with a little happy face on it. And then someone gave up.
Yeah, that's all it is. But and also it's weird because they because it's an egg, it's white. But the ZX Spectrum can only do, I mean, it wasn't originally made for the ZX Spectrum, but it was made for a computer that had a similar palette. So it wasn't, you know, they only had a couple of colors to play with. So yeah. Generally speaking, his body is white and his eyes are black. And he has these black cavernous eyes with a little, you know, a single pixel white pupil inside. But somehow, just something about how they pulled it off, the number of pixels they used and in what order, it didn't look threatening, at least not originally. There have been versions of it that looked a bit creepy, but the original sprite was actually quite nice. And he wiggled all the time. He wiggled up and down. That was a little characteristic they gave him, perhaps to make him look less dead. He would just bob up and down. And as he did, his hands would kind of flap, almost like wings. But it was just... And it meant nothing. When you look at it now on YouTube, you'll go, what is that? That's manic and frightening, this little thing flapping up and down. But at the time, based on what we were used to on the Spectrum, it did look sweet. And the way the game plays is you are walking around in a number of screens. It couldn't scroll because not many games could. That was a very, you know, labor and resource intensive thing. So instead, and this was common for Spectrum games, you would just walk to the edge of the screen and it would flick to the next screen. So you were walking through a series of tableaus, essentially. And you would, a little diorama, and you would start and you're in the village and there's a cauldron and there's a well and there's a tree and there's a little spider hanging from the tree on a thread. And if you touch him, you die. And then you go to the next screen and there's some more houses and it's somewhere else. And this was so perfect for telling fairy tale type stories, it turned out, because each screen had a little name on a little scroll at the top. And so, you know, it would say, you know, welcome to the village or whatever. And Dizzy, what you had to do is you walked around and you could carry, I think it was three objects, or it might even have just been one object in the first game. And you could pick something up. So you'd be walking around, you'd find a thing just lying there, and you'd pick it up, and you would take it to where you needed that thing. And by dropping it, you would use it to solve the puzzle. So if you found a key, you take it to a door, you drop it, that opens the door, right? As the games progressed, it got more advanced. And so you had like a little menu that would come up telling you the things you were holding. And it was usually like three things, or if you found the bag, five things, that sort of thing. And you were doing these puzzles and you had to remember where you'd left objects if your inventory filled up. And he gradually started to gain friends. And so by the end of the series, he had the Yolk Folk, who were these other eggs that used to hang out with him. And there was like the girlfriend one and the sister one and the sleepy one. They were a bit like the Seven Dwarfs as well. So there was a sleepy one. There was a stupid one. Was there a stupid one? No, there wasn't. There was
a dopey one.
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking of. But there wasn't. There was a dozy one. There dozy. Was so that was the sleepy one. There was a cool dude one. There was a hippie one. There was an old one. And you just went round, and they would all, you know, be in trouble. They would be kidnapped in some way, and you had to find the way to get them free. And just something about this was amazing to me. I first saw it in a shop, the aforementioned WH Smith's, but a different branch. There was this box that was like, we've got the Dizzy collection, here he is, it's Dizzy in his own collection. I'm like, okay, who was that? And then a demo came out on one of the Spectrum games magazines, because they would come with a tape, literally just sellotape to the cover, that would have little demos on of games. And they had a demo of Magic Land Dizzy, which was the one that was out at the time and was on this collection. And it just blew my mind, because it might have been the first time that I played a game that was a story unfolding in game form. You know, we've all experienced, there's no end of RPGs and stuff now, and there probably was then. In fact, I'm fairly sure there'd been some Final Fantasies out in Japan. Not outside Japan, I don't think, but... you know, the genre had begun anyway, put it that way. But not really here, and I'd never seen anything like it. So the fact that I could go up to characters and they were talking to me and it was progressing a little story, even if the story was just, you know, how Dizzy got through this place, it was it was incredible to be able to talk, have little conversations with these little guys, and it all looked so sweet and cartoony. And then, so I got the collection for my 9th birthday, and it was just amazing. It came with like 4 whole games. There was the original Dizzy, that's subtitled The Ultimate Cartoon Adventure, Treasure Island Dizzy, mm-hmm. Fantasy World Dizzy, and Magic Land. And those three are still the ones that people think of as like the main Dizzy games, because they were like the peak of it. And they were just huge, sprawling games with just these... I mean, I've still not finished most of them. They were they were incredible. They were just so packed with stuff to do. And you felt like, especially in Magic Land Dizzy, but also like Fantasy World Dizzy, you felt like you were in a storybook land and you were just like exploring this world and interacting. So like there's Magic Land Dizzy has, you know, there's a witch stirring a cauldron who's lost her little cat and you have to find the cat for her. And there's a Dozy has fallen asleep forever because he's taken a bite of the apple from Snow White. So he's asleep on a stone plinth and you have to rub a magic lamp. And when you rub a magic lamp, a genie comes out and kills you because his electricity comes out and kills you. So you have to find a lightning rod, put it next to Dozy, rub the lamp, the lightning zaps Dozy, that wakes him up. Stuff like that. Like, it's... Yeah. You go down a well and there's like... There's, you know, you play panpipes to a rat to get it out of your way and things like that. It was amazing. There was all these wonderful things going on. It was great. And so...
Sounds like the closest thing we had in America was Sierra Games.
Yeah.
We had King's Quest and Heroes Quest and Police Quest, which were... You walked around and you had to collect the right things to make the right things happen or you died.
Exactly. But the difference was that those games are quite advanced point-and-click adventures. This was... they called them, like, I think, like, arcade puzzlers or something. So, essentially, it worked the same as a normal game. So, you were this guy and you pressed left and right and jump to move him around. And so, there were jumping puzzles. Like, there were bits where, because he was an egg, he would roll if you landed wrong. So, you would have to, you started to get a sense, like you did in Sonic a couple of years later, of, like, if you landed on this surface, would he roll when he landed on it? Which way would he go? What angle did he need to jump off to get there safely? And things like this. And some of them, the jump had to be pixel perfect. You had to know exactly what pixel to stand on to get him to land. So there was a lot of trial and error. And this is true of the Sierra games as well. You had to learn the game by playing it again and again and again and again.
Oh, right.
And you would... as with the Sierra games, you would die a lot. But yes, otherwise, there is definitely a kinship between those two things. For sure. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, this element of, especially at the time, of your... Someone has created a product that allows us to go into another world.
Yeah.
And explore. Like, the idea that, like, there's not as many edges as there used to be. Like, you can keep pushing boundaries into this world. And what's in this cave? Can you actually open this door?
Exactly.
That was something that hadn't existed for when I was a kid. Like, the first time I ever played a King's Quest game, I was astounded. I thought, this is just like being in a real world.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it was like. It was like your computer has been opened up to this new thing. I came to the point and click genre late. I literally didn't know about it. Didn't know about Monkey Island until Simon the Sorcerer on the Amiga. Have you ever played that?
I have not played that.
So Simon the Sorcerer is like, imagine if Monkey Island comes out, and more or less the legacy of Monkey Island has been that Monkey Island 2 followed it, and that took that same formula of like a Sierra game but just funny. And, you know, never taking itself seriously. But also, by doing that, still a really solid, proper game. Not just a joke game, like a really good, real point-and-click adventure with an unfolding, you know, satisfying puzzles and plot and all of that. But then it kind of stopped, or at least moved on. So you get, you know, you get Monkey Island, you get Monkey Island 2. Monkey Island 3 was like a high-res cartoon game on, you know, advanced PCs.
Right.
And then, you know, you're straight into things like Grim Fandango after that. And... But instead of that, imagine if Monkey Island 1 and 2 had been the opening salvo in a genre that had lasted a long time. Mm. Beneath the Steel Sky is an example of that. That's an entry in that series. In that genre. And Simon the Sorcerer, I think, is the best it ever got. Simon the Sorcerer is a beautiful game, first off, just to look at. It's incredible. I'd never seen the like on, and I didn't have the full AGA chipset Amiga 1200. I had a 500 plus, and just the graphics that came out of Simon the Saw. There's this whole sequence where you're in a cave, in the house of this odd little bog monster, and he is just insisting on serving you this disgusting stew that he's making. And he's, you know, this lovely little guy, and he wants to be your friend, and he's eager to please, but he's, you know, he stinks and his food makes you throw up. And he's, and so it's like there's this long sequence of him just pottering about his house while you have time to do little, you know, click things and do things while he isn't looking. And he's just chatting on stuff like that. Yeah. It was a real powerhouse of like everything we can do by now on Amiga or PC, because it was on PC as well. It wasn't Amiga exclusive or anything. And the animation frames were just ridiculous how many there were. The music on the Amiga, not on the PC, you got to listen to the Amiga version, was gorgeous. And it was colourful and beautiful and really funny and really, really good. And that was my first exposure to the whole genre of point and click. And so it really was like just a magic spell. It was a revelation cast upon my computer in the same way that it sounds like those King's Quest games were for you.
Well, and I came to them before they were called point and click. Oh. Because there was nothing to point or click with.
Oh yeah, you I actually played the only one I've played is King's Quest 1, the original one.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, I'm going to stream this, so I did. And like yeah, you have to like type.
It's all cursors and type. It's all you typed pick up book. You typed read book, and if you didn't know the exact thing it wanted you to type, you just kept guessing. I think the first one I played was King's Quest 3, which is separate from the rest of the series, and it's just about your poor kid who's trying to escape from an evil wizard's house.
Oh, cool.
Which, of course, involves like you having to travel the entire world, yeah, like to escape an evil wizard's house, but and incomprehensible puzzles. But I didn't have a computer with a mouse until like the late 90s.
Oh right, yeah, yeah. I was mid 90s, but yeah, and that, because Spectrum was just joystick. You know, I think you probably could get a mouse for the Spectrum, but there's no point. There was nothing they could do.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Dizzy was, it was like a precursor to that sort of thing, where you were, it just made it easier to do that kind of interaction. You're just walking back and forth. These games come out, and it comes with this pack. So you got Dizzy. That's a very primitive one. You're just wandering around this village collecting items to go in a potion, which, by the way, was inspired by, or you could say copied from, an episode of the cartoon series Danger Mouse, in which Danger Mouse had to do the same thing. And in fact, one of the items was even the same, you know, item that you had to find as Dizzy to get rid of the evil wizard.
That's funny, yeah.
Then there was Fantasy World Dizzy. No, sorry. Then there was Treasure Island Dizzy. Dizzy's stuck on a treasure island. There's coins to pick up everywhere. It's very piratey feeling. It was cool. There was insta deaths though, so it wasn't without its problems. And then yeah, Fantasy World Dizzy came out, and it just perfected the formula. Suddenly you start off locked in the basement, in the dungeon of a castle. You break out of there by solving a puzzle. You find your way out. You're walking around this land, this fantasy world, and there's all sorts of cool stuff going on, and there's a dragon, there's all sorts of cool stuff. And then the Oliver Twins stopped making them. Except there was a puzzle game they made called Fast Food, which was basically just Pac-Man, but a bit different. So you're Dizzy instead of Pac-Man. And in this, instead of it being dots everywhere that you have to pick up, it's like, you know, 10 items on screen or less. And they are, yeah, a milkshake, a burger, stuff like that. But they are moving around as well. So you're having to chase them while the monsters that look a bit like ghosts are coming after you. So that was quite fun. That was in the Dizzy collection. And then the Oliver Twins outsourced the next game to, I think they were called like Big Red Software or something like that. And it was Magic Land Dizzy. And that has always been my favourite one. They just polished it. They took the Fantasy World Dizzy formula, they polished it. And it was just flawless as far as I'm concerned. It was really just tight. And that was that. That was the first collection of games. And I was a huge fan of Dizzy. And I was writing sequels to the Dizzy games and stuff like this. And I was... That was my life was Dizzy right now.
Well, but Dizzy was a character who, if you were a kid at the time, you would have recognized this character.
Depends.
Like if you saw it.
It depends. If you were a kid who had one of these computers, you would, or was engaged in that sort of world. If you didn't have, it wasn't like Sonic where you know, he had a TV series or anything like that. He didn't have anything. He was just a series of video games.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Like, he never expanded past the computer.
Sadly not, no. But if you had a Spectrum, then you knew who Dizzy was for sure, because there was just no escaping it. He was always at the top of the charts. You've always saw his games on the shelves. In fact, latterly, they started putting trading cards in the games. Like, not digital ones, physical ones. So you would open up the box and see which one you'd got. And they were well known. There was a bit of merchandise, but you had to send off for it from the card with the games. And I never did.
But man, if you had a Dizzy hat, like, that's like putting out your colors. Like, that's like saying, like,
exactly.
If you see this and you know what this is, like, we are on the same
exactly
page.
I would dearly love now to have the Dizzy baseball cap, but I didn't send off for one. And it's just for the same reason as I didn't see the Ninja Turtles movie in the cinema or get a game whenever I asked for it. It's just something that it never occurred to me I would be allowed to do. And I still don't know if I was or not. Like, this went to some extremes. Like, I assumed throughout my childhood that I wasn't allowed bubblegum because that was for teenagers. And one day, I just, like, I don't know, 10 or 9 or something, and I just said to Mum, like, can I have some bubble gum? And she went, yeah, I don't see why not. And, like, what? I had no idea that was allowed. What? So my parents must have been quite pleased on that level. I just assumed I wasn't allowed stuff. Well, anyway, so I never got any of the merchandise. I didn't have the wall clock. I didn't have the mug. I didn't have the sports bag. And that, I think, is it.
Well, it's funny because I came from a similar situation. Mm. Like, I came from a suburban family. We did okay.
Yeah.
Like, we weren't hurting for money, but I hated asking my parents for things. Mm. I hated just the thought of, like, bothering them and being like, is it okay? So I would always, you know, you would wait until your birthday or until Christmas to get, like, the big ticket items. And it did create this kind of, like, dry spell between my birthday was in the summer. And so, like, there was this intense, like, pop cultural dry spell between those two ends of the year for me where you just had to kind of exist. Unless you saved up your allowance, you existed in this sort of nebulous space where nothing new was coming into the house until.
Well, this was why it was important to befriend people who had birthdays throughout the year.
Yes. Or befriend the kid who wasn't afraid to ask the parents for more stuff, because that was that was a huge thing. It was like going to friends' houses and learning more about this world to which you were only privy to a part.
That's what you did, because when you went around a friend's house, it was like everyone knew what each other's house contained. So it was like, today I want to play on a Mega Drive, so I'll go around this kid's house, whatever.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as selfish as that. You did first arrange to see the friend, but, like, once you did, you were like, yes, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I had one friend who had an Amiga, and he lived far away, so it was only when the parents arranged it that we could see
each
other.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the Amiga was like, that was an that was a world that no one else knew about because it was open to games that no one had heard of. The graphics were incredible. The music was astounding. And he was the only person I knew who played those games.
Was that, and what did he have?
It was late 80s, very early 90s.
Oh, that is early for Amiga kid, yeah.
But his father was like a computer guy. Well, I wrote about this on Twitter. He had a game that I've been searching for years now. I don't know the name of it. I don't know. I've tried describing it. I've never found screenshots of it. If I could get my hands on it, I know I would be. That would be it. Like, that would be like I could be done.
Yeah.
I could just settle into the rest of my life having finally discovered this game. It's this mystery game that just only exists in my memory, and I don't even know the guy anymore, so I can't even, like, write. It would be weird to, like, write to him and be like, what was that computer game that I always insisted on playing when I was at your house?
I think you should do that anyway. I'm trying to get the guts up to, and I don't know why guts are required for this, apart from what you've just described, the sense that, like, adults shouldn't care about this, but I want to know what game it was that I played around my cousin's house when I was a toddler.
Ah.
But they're, like, quite a lot older than me, So presumably they'll know. They probably will remember. But like,
but see, I have such a history of like bringing that up, that yeah. kind of thing up with people, and they're like,
I know.
How would I remember they that? Just... And I'm like, well, of course you should remember. Yeah, exactly. It was part of your childhood.
So go on. What was this game like?
It was you were on a space station, I assume. Uh-huh. It was on a planet, like it was in a you. It didn't have. It wasn't scrolling. It was you walked. Like the screen was divided into two levels, like two floors, and you would walk in and out of doors, into like rooms. There would be like guards, like on computers and stuff, and you could interact with them. If I remember, mm-hmm. there were cameras watching you, and I think you had to like get keys or cards and shut off certain computers. It's all very vague. I remember you could go outdoors, but I remember being fascinated by it because the sprite of your guy would actually like turn and go out the door and walk in the door and the doors would close and there was sound effects, and that's kind of all I remember about it. It wasn't cartoony, it was as realistic. It gave me the same, it was abstract and weird enough that it gave me the same feeling I get when I look at like Judge Dredd comics now. Like it felt like it came from another place. Like there was nothing, there was no cultural touchstone for me as a kid. Like I don't understand like what I'm like. This is a completely different kind of gaming experience. Like, and so if I saw like a 2000 AD comic at that age, I would be like, I don't understand. Like, I don't understand how this even works. Like, what am I looking at? So yeah, it's this weird Amiga game that exists, and maybe I will write to that friend. Who I think lives in Florida now, and just be like, I know I haven't spoken to you in about 30 years. Yeah. What was the name of this game that I used to play at your house?
Yeah.
But I do have the experience, though, of like friends of mine saying, like, why do you remember this specific cartoon? Why do you remember this specific comic strip? That why do you remember this thing I said when we were kids that I don't even remember I said? And I'm like, because that's I don't know. It meant that much to me. It meant so much to me that like I still bring up stuff like this today. It shaped my outlook on the way the world works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I think you should write to him, but first, I think let's have another go at tracking it down on Twitter. Just like write everything you can remember down. Also, draw it. Draw little pictures.
Oh, I should do that.
Because then people will go, I know, because they might not describe it in the same terms you do. But if they see something that's a vague diagram, or I don't know how well you can draw, like a really good picture of it, then they'll be like, well, I know what that is. That's this. That's that. Because it sounds cool. I want to have a go on it.
Because Amiga games, there's about 17,000 of them.
Exactly.
Came and went, so well, who knows?
So the game that I want to know what it is, and maybe one of your listeners knows, it was on what I, based on the other games they had, have ascertained was something like a Tandy a Dragon 32 or something, I think they were called. Old computer, anyway. And what this game was, and I was a very small child. Like, yeah. I was out of nappies, but not long. So I was little at this age, and So it's a very vague memory. But what I do remember is that on the table we had this folded out, like the real table, the physical table, not in the computer. Yeah. We had this unfolded map type thing, which was like a game board. It was that sort of, it was printed on that sort of thing, and my vague memory is of it having an illustration of a cave network or something with little characters all over it. There was something like a little golem looking up type character. What you did was you went, okay, well, I'm going to go to this cave, and I don't know whether it was a number system or something, but you went over to the computer and you told it that you wanted that one, and then it would bring up text telling you what was there. And I think there might even have been like a tape to play that was the audio to go along with that moment or something. How you got the right bit of tape, I don't know. So maybe I'm misremembering that. I just remember this map corresponding with this game. And the trouble is that people keep telling me that oh, well, that must be Zork then, because that was a game that was like a text adventure that you also had a physical map. But it doesn't look right. I've never seen a Zork map that resembles what I'm remembering, because they're these sort of kind of black and white maps that I don't know, they seem to be like maps of text adventures, you know, how I would imagine that. Whereas this, I think, was a full color, because I think there was a lot of dark, misty blue, like illustration, almost like painting style.
Yeah.
And that is all I remember. So if anyone knows what that is, do let me know.
Yeah, it has to mean there couldn't have been that. So it was a text adventure.
Well, I don't know. It must have been. Okay. Well, my memory of it is that rather than it being a text adventure, it was more like you just like cross-reference. So like you look at the map you've got and you just say to the computer, tell me that room, and it does.
Okay.
Rather than it being, you know, now I'm going east, now I'm going east. But I could be wrong about that. That could just have been sleight of hand by my cousins who were like guiding me through it, you know?
It does sound like something that would have come out early in computer time when they were like trying to figure out how to make things. Yeah, yeah. Boy, this is gonna. If any listeners out there are above a certain age and remember playing this, oh, that would drive me nuts too. Yeah, because like, yeah, we had like the one neighbor who had a computer, and so the kids would sometimes go over and like play text adventures. Mm-hmm. And you'd have one experience and you'd remember it fondly, but then you'd go on with your life and then be like, what was that weird game I played at that neighbor's house? And then, and it's important, dang it.
Actually, my first, like my earliest computer's memory is one of those. It's that this can't be true, but my memory is that I was, well, I know for a fact that I was about two or younger because of where I was living at the time. And I was so just newly able to walk, basically. And I remember being in the back garden, and there was a bit in the fence between, you know, our house and the next door house that I could fit through if I squeezed through it. And I just remember doing that. I remember squeezing through and just deciding to go and see the boy who lived next door. And now that's the part that can't be true. You know, the way I remember it, it's like a secret garden style adventure. Like I just decided to go to this place. But, you know, clearly mum would have said, like, you know, presumably the other mum was there as well. And my mum would have said, oh, can he come round? And she would have gone, yes, over he comes. And, you know, I would have just toddled over there. But the memory is that I did go off by myself, went into their house, and just went in. And in the front room, I remember sitting down on a sofa in front of one of those big TV units that they used to have in the 80s, you know, where it was like a big construction of cupboards and shelves around a television.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And on this television, it said Three Blind Mice. And it was a computer of some sort game. And it said Three Blind Mice. And my memory has always been of three mice on the screen, really crudely drawn in old graphics, just going up and down, like blip, 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 in stages, like, the, you know, the way cartoons make you think computer games are when they show them.
Right.
Blip, 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 blip. And it's playing Three Blind Mice, the song. That's it. That's my memory. And the boy who lived there was playing it, and I was just watching. And that does turn out to be a real game. Which was, it really was on one of the old computers. It really does play the Three Blind Mice song. And I think what you're doing is you are running away from a cat or something. You know, that sort of thing. It makes sense. So that will be what I saw. I can't find it now, so I don't know any details about that. But I did find it. So that exists. So yes, that was real. So I am remembering things that were real, just sort of
right.
Slightly askew. Anyway, Dizzy, right? So the Dizzy collection's come out. I've had it for about what must have been about a year or so, which, of course, you know, when you're 9 years old is 100,000 years. And then they announce a second Dizzy collection. Not the next game, but a whole new collection.
collection. Yeah.
And that's like incredible news. I couldn't believe it. What had now emerged as my favorite computer game of all time, especially if you allow the collection to be one thing, is suddenly another one is happening. It's happening again. Must have felt like when Empire Strikes Back comes out or something. It was monumental to me. And so what was going to be on this was a new game called Spellbound Dizzy and another new game called Prince of the Oakfolk Dizzy and some other stuff. And news was coming out about Spellbound. I was reading games magazines by this time. I was old enough to be actually like into them. And there was all this talk about how, the new Dizzy's coming out. It's going to be more screens than probably all the previous Dizzy games put together. It's going to be absolutely enormous. And it's got all animation frames that the others didn't have. So, like, as well as just walking and jumping and wiggling and rolling, now Dizzy can, like, eat food, and there's a whole animation of him chewing it. There, he can, if he falls down too far, he's going to land on the floor and stars are going to go around his head. And, like, this is all really basic stuff to us now, but at the time, it was like, no way. How have they even managed this? It was just incredible to conceive of this. There was at least one kid at school who lied about having already played it. That was the sort of thing this was.
Wow.
And so this comes out, and I am like, oh my God, we see it in town. We see it there. There it is. And I'm like, oh, can I have it? I've got to have it. And the answer was no, because I did have to save up my pocket money for it. You know, I couldn't just have it just because it was the most important thing in the whole wide world. And I, like, didn't know how to deal with that. It was, I remember the feeling of it. It was like, no, but this is different. I know I've got to save up for it, but, like, I've got to have it now, though. Like, I'll save up for it and pay you back, but we've got to have it. And it was like, well, no, you'll have it when you have it. And I was borderline terrified, because the flashback to a few years earlier, there had been flashback even further to several years earlier, we had a record in our LP collection of the soundtrack to the film Dougal and the Blue Cat, which was the Magic Roundabout movie. Do you know about the Magic Roundabout? Yeah.
I do know the Magic Roundabout.
Well, this was the movie, not the gross CG one they brought out a few years ago.
Right.
This was a made by the same people, fully stop motion animated, came out in 1974 or something. Magic Roundabout movie. And we had the record of it. And they had taken what was a mono soundtrack, and I don't know how they'd done it, probably just with reverb effects, but they'd made it into a stereo soundtrack. Mm. And so it had, and the film is already quite spooky. It's about, haunted sounds in the night that turn out to be this sort of invader. And so it had this eerie quality to it. It had this immersiveness to it. And it was the main Magic Roundabout thing I knew, because, it had all finished years before I was born. So I just had the record cover, which had a big picture of all of the cast. And I was just looking at that, and, my mum would point to which one was which. Well, this came out on video, finally. For the first time, it came out on video. Don't think it had even been shown on TV. And I was like, well, we've got to have this. Because it was almost like this record had always been. And I don't even know if it was my record or if it was like my parents or something. Like, I don't know whose record this was, but it had just always been there in our house. So it was almost as if a video had come out of like our own, like that, that holiday we went on or whatever. It was like someone else had released our home videos. That was how important to me and my sense of our family this was. But I wasn't allowed it. And it was like, Mum said, okay, look, I'll make you a deal. Here's what we'll do. Because I was too young to even save up for anything. I don't even know if I had pocket money at that point. She was like, right, here's what we'll do. If you can be good for a whole day at school, or maybe it was a whole week, I don't know what it's like. It must have been a whole day. But anyway, if I was really good in some way, my teacher would give me what we called a peg. And what this was it was like just a little plastic cylinder that was designed to fit onto other plastic cylinders of its same sort. So it was like imagine the one block Lego bricks that are just like a little You know, not a cube, yeah. A bit taller than that, and with a peg on top. Imagine that, but right. Bigger for you know, tiny child hands to hold, and plastic and round. It was that. And if I could get 10 of these pegs stacked up, then I could have the video. So I worked for this. I was the best behaved. I was doing all my schoolwork. I was being really good. And I got my 10 pegs, and it took a while, and there was a couple of, like, real frustrations along the way where, like, I talked too much, so the teacher took a peg away, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And eventually I get to 10 pegs. And I was allowed to have the video. So we went and we got to get the video, and it was gone. You couldn't find it anywhere.
Oh, no.
Because it was limited run. And, you could only get them for a certain amount of time. And eventually we found one, and we took it home, and it was like, first off, it was amazing and incredible and wonderful, but at the same time, because I was seeing this for the first time as well as hearing it, and it was an expanded version, you know, or rather the record was edited down, so I was like, oh my god, what am I seeing? This is amazing. But the tracking on the video was awful. It was one of those, remember tracking?
Oh.
So...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So these, like, the whole bottom half of the screen was just fuzz. And then sometimes the sound would switch off. And, like, you couldn't watch it. You just couldn't. So we had to get another one. And it was gone. You couldn't get it anymore. So we sent off. We wrote to the company or phoned them up or something. And they said, oh, yeah, don't worry. Swap it. We'll send it back to us. We'll send you a new one. So Mum posted off this video. And there's waiting and there's waiting and there's waiting. And then the video turns up. And I put it in, and I swear to you this is true. I don't even understand how this can happen, but I swear this is what happened. We put the video in, and it starts off, and it has, like, it says Dougal and the Blue Cat, like in old computer text. You know, like when you would get a glimpse before a TV show came. Well, I don't know if it worked this way in America, but before a TV show would come on, you'd get a glimpse of, like, a seconds hand counting up to when it should be on. In white on black with sort of code around it. And it was just this really old-fashioned thing. Well, it was like that for Dougal and the Blue Cat. And then that got to the top, or it counted down, or whatever it was doing. And then it went to black. And that was it. That was all that was on the tape. It was just a blank tape. Not a blank tape like you got VHS tapes in those days. So it wasn't It wasn't just snow. They had printed blackness from start to end of the tape. And so what it must have been, I've never thought of this before, but this is the only time I've come up with the solution. What it must have been is that they did just print some wrong at first. Like, they did a test run and it was wrong. You know, within the margin. They probably just did three or something, and then it's like, no, that hasn't worked, do it again. And then they printed it correctly, and then they sent that to be reproduced. And they must have just still had them lying around in the studio or wherever it was they made it, and they must have just gone, oh, he wants Dougal and the Blue Cat, this says Dougal and the Blue Cat, I'll give him that, not realizing that, you know, what I had was a reject tape from the start of production. And that really was it. Like, we got back in touch with the company, they're like, no, that was the last one. There are no more copies of this in the United Kingdom. The end. And I was devastated by that. And then, you know, what could have only been a couple of months later, someone else just printed it again. And after that, you could get it anywhere. It was pretty fine after, you know. So I did eventually get it. It was great. It was perfect. I had a wonderful time. Brilliant. But that meant that now, fast forward to now, I'm not allowed the Dizzy collection. And it's the same situation. And I know that this is going to be gone because Mum said no. And she'll have had some reason to say no, but, like, she said no, and that wasn't acceptable. But I had no recourse. And I remember I had to just, like, go and stand somewhere else and have, like, calm down. Like, I just stormed off. Like, when we were walking back to the car, and I couldn't deal with it. And I had to just go and stand away from them. And Mum agreed. Like, she recognised that I needed some time to myself. So she just sat down on a bench and waited where she could see me. But I was just standing, leaning against a nearby wall until I could get my breath back. Because it was like...
And how old would you have been at this point?
10.
10.
And so I was just having a tantrum. But it really felt like, this is the end.
Yes.
So we set up another system, like the pegs. And I always maintained that it was Pegs again, but now I think about it, I think it might have been stickers, and I think it might have been Mum awarding the stickers this time, because I actually had a really horrible teacher that at that point, and I wonder if, like, Mum didn't like her either and knew that she wouldn't help because she was horrible. But, yeah, I think I was getting stickers. So I had this folded over piece of cardboard that was you know, getting filled up with these big stickers. And when it got filled up, they were big stickers. When it got filled up, because I'd been good, then I could have the games. And this time it worked. This time I got it.
Oh, you did get it?
Yes. And it was perfect. So this time it came with the following games. We'll start with the throwaway ones. Dizzy Down the Rapids. This was another spin-off puzzle game, like Fast Food, where you're just in a barrel going down a river and there's crocodiles and stuff shooting at you. And that was it. Okay, fine. There was Dizzy Panic, which was easy to dismiss, but was actually brilliant. It had nothing to do with Dizzy. It was just a game where there were pipes at the top of the screen, four pipes, and they were releasing shapes. And they would be, and it was like made to look like a factory. And the shapes were like circles or stars or triangles. And they were seen in perspective. They were supposed to be flat and falling down. And at the bottom of the screen, there was a long strip that you had of like basically holes in those shapes. But they were randomly distributed and it didn't correspond to what shapes were going down. So you had to move the strip left and right to line up the holes. But of course, as the game goes on, it's speeding up. The shapes are coming down faster. Three of them are coming down at the same time, and you're trying to find ways to make two go in at once. So you're having to find a bit where, even though the shapes are randomly distributed, maybe a circle there will be four places away from a triangle over there. So you get it and you line it up. And then every time you lose a piece by it lands not in the correct hole and explodes, the pipes go down a bit as the machinery starts to break. So Tetris style, by the end of the game, it's going like, bah, 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 and you're having to zoom it. And, you know, brilliant game. Really good idea for a puzzle
game. Bit of a note, if anyone Googles Dizzy Panic, you're just going to get websites about anxiety disorders.
Oh.
I just discovered that.
Oh, what a shame. Well, Dizzy Panic ZX Spectrum then.
Yes.
It also had Quick Snacks, which was marvelous little game where you were, obviously the name is a sequel to Fast Food, but this one wasn't like Pac-Man. This one was, you were on a screen, a picture of Pac-Man screen, except the mazes are not made up of like just walls. They're made up of blocks, like, and depending on the theme of the level. So the ice level, they're ice cubes, things like that. And you can push those blocks. And once you push them, they just keep going until they hit something else.
Hmm.
And if you walk in a direction, you just keep going until you hit something else. And so what you have to do is you're pushing these blocks around, trying to collect the pieces of food, which aren't moving this time. But, and you can get them in any order, and there are enemies around the place. But sometimes they'll, like in Yoshi's Story, if you're familiar with that, they'll be a best one you can get. And it'll start to flash, and you'll want to go and get that pineapple first. That sort of thing. But if you get it wrong, actually, no, I think it was just in the bonus stages where you kept going until you stopped. But anyway, you can get it wrong and you can get hurt and so on. And then, as I say, you have these bonus stages where you're just going forever until you hit something. And if you did it wrong and you make a path all the way across the screen, then essentially you lose a life once it's been established that you're going to be going forever. Anyway, that was a cool game.
Yes.
But then there was Spellbound Dizzy and Prince of the Oak Folk. Spellbound was exactly what it purported to be. It was this huge game. You go underground in this one, and you're in this giant chasmous underground world with caves everywhere and this huge network of pipes to get through, and just like all your friends are trapped magically and you have to save them. And it was, you know, it was oppressively big. It didn't have the fun fairy tale feel that Magic Land or Fantasy World did. It felt kind of spooky, and I didn't really like it, but it was amazing and it was colossal, and I never got anywhere near to finishing it until, and this changed my life, there was a cheat mode that, you know, was found out about, and it was leaked in, well, not leaked, you know, they probably printed it deliberately, but what it was that you typed in "I want an omelette" and that unlocked cheat mode. And what this meant was that you could now acquire any object you wanted. It was like a debug mode, and that is probably what it was. Yeah. It was probably for the coders to use. But you could now get any item you wanted at any time. But also, you could zap between screens in any way you wanted. So all of the puzzles that were keeping you locked in certain areas, you didn't have to solve them anymore. You could still see the new areas, which sounds like a way to drain all the fun out of the game. But for a 10-year-old who just, I don't know, feels frustrated, it felt like, you know, unlimited power. It was amazing.
And I think you and Chris have talked about how back in the day, cheat codes were just kind of a part of the video game experience.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't solely about proving you could do it. A lot of it was about just seeing what was beyond.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was what it was. Yeah, you had this content that you couldn't reach, and now you can. And interestingly, there was a room in the game that you could only get to by using this cheat, and it had a scroll in it, and you open the scroll and it says welcome to the 131st room or whatever it is. We don't know how you got here, but welcome. And what was really fun was that you could even warp into the title screen. That was just on the map. You could just walk around in the title screen, drop things in it, rearrange things, and then quit the game, and it would still be like that. So it really, it felt magic. But then the last game was called Prince of the Oak Folk, and it was so good. It was just, it was back to being a small game. And it was exclusive to this pack, or at least that was what it purported to be. Actually, they released it separately very soon afterwards, and I was cross. But it was this exclusive game. It was small. It was just a perfectly honed little diamond where it was like all the lessons they learned making Magic Land Dizzy and Fantasy World Dizzy had now been, honed down into a something more compact, quicker, easy. You know, I did complete the game. That was probably the first Dizzy I ever finished without following a guide. And so satisfying and so nice. And it was just great. And that's the one that they re-released for phones a few years ago.
Yeah, I think there's one of them. Was this one of the ones that they released for the Nintendo?
Sort of. Yeah, around this time, they did start trying to take Dizzy out of the computers and put him onto the consoles. And this was the downfall of Dizzy, ultimately, because he was at home as a cheap £4 budget game, but with, you know, AAA heart, as it were.
Yeah.
When you put him on the consoles, suddenly he started to feel like people who didn't quite know what consoles were all about having a go. It felt a bit Me Too, I'll have a go, I'll make a game for the consoles. And it didn't help that Codemasters were putting out their own shaped, they were manufacturing their own cartridges that weren't the correct shape. They fitted, they worked, but they were they weren't official. I don't think they ever had a Nintendo seal of quality, that sort of thing. They brought out, there was one game called The Fantastic Adventures of Dizzy that they brought out on the NES, which was sort of like a best of all the Dizzy games. It had all these different bits from all of them. And there was I don't mean it was like Mario All-Stars. I mean, it was one game, one adventure, but it had aspects of various different Dizzy games.
Oh, I see.
And as if to bring, you know, console owners up to speed, sort of. But then they brought out a Game Gear collection, which had something called Go Dizzy Go, which was, or was it Dizzy the Adventurer? One of those was Prince of the Oak Folk under a different name. And the other one, whichever of those two names is, wasn't that one, was also one of the other games under a different name, Quick Snacks or something. And then Panic Dizzy, they brought out a game called Dizzy Panic.
I've heard you guys discuss this one.
Yeah, that's right. Or maybe it was the other way around anyway. But yeah, I think it was Dizzy Panic on the Spectrum, Panic Dizzy on the Game Gear, which was just a completely different game, but with another name. So anyway, it was confusing. And then it all led to the confusion that happened right at the end of Dizzy's life. And this was the release of Crystal Kingdom Dizzy, which was the first Spectrum game, Dizzy Spectrum game, to be full budget price, full price. So it was £10 as opposed to £4. And so you had to have it for your birthday or Christmas. There was no way around it. And £10 was a lot in those days. And it was it came in a fancy box instead of just a tape with an inlay. It came in a little box and it had a map with it and stuff. Wait, did it? No, it had It might have had stickers or a badge or something. It came with something anyway. And it was rubbish.
Oh.
It was like, it was as if they lost the source code and had to start from scratch. And I mean that. Like, nothing about it was right. It had a kind of enemy, like, it had enemies walking around in a way that the Dizzy games hadn't had since they started, because it had become really tiresome. And, that was associated with the early ones that they weren't very, good at. They were good for the time, but they moved on from that. And then here they were back again, just snakes walking back and forth that drain your life when you hit them more. Dizzy, the graphics themselves were kind of jumbled looking and crap looking, and it didn't have the aesthetic that Dizzy games did, because from essentially like Fantasy World onwards, there was a visual language that they all shared. I mean, they shared assets, they had the same building blocks, or they built on those in ways that seemed right. This game didn't. It was totally different. It looked nothing like... It looked like a knockoff. And the worst thing was the way he jumped. So Dizzy, right from the first game, he had a very distinctive jump. You would jump and turn one somersault and land on your feet. And if you were jumping left, he would jump left. If you were jumping right, he would jump right. If you weren't holding a direction at all, he would jump facing the camera. So there was two different, sprite banks for this animation, and of course the sideways one would just flip, but then there was this head-on version as well. And in the first game you could tell that the spectrum or the code was having trouble making this happen. He would kind of flicker on and off as he moved in that game, but from the second one onwards it was smooth and it was clear and crisp and it was lovely, and you really had by that you'd got the feel of how Dizzy jumped, what the weight of him was, what it was like. Like I said, you knew where you would land when you jumped.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, in Crystal Kingdom Dizzy, on the Spectrum that is, it didn't work anymore. He turned about three somersaults in the air. It was too fast. It was back. I don't think it flickered on and off, but it was back to feeling like it flickered on and off. There was nothing about his weight that the animation didn't match what he was. It was just like a sprite turning now. And what was the worst was they didn't include the forward-facing jump. So if you just stood still and jumped, he turned to the side to jump, facing the side.
Oh.
It was disgusting. It was there was something really nasty about it. And I never got anywhere in it. It just wasn't good. The music, as in all the Dizzy games, was absolutely brilliant. But that was it. But then, on the Amiga, Crystal Kingdom Dizzy came out, and it was really well made. It was proper. It was, you could argue, the first true 16-bit Dizzy game, because all the other ones had been like interestingly weird conversions of the 8-bit games, and some of them done to great success. The 16-bit version of Fantasy World Dizzy was, it had a look that was like plush. It was like AAA product. He wasn't just an oval with a little smiley face. He was Dizzy, the full character, with his hat and with his boxing gloves, all of it. Because he had a hat and boxing gloves, folks. Then Magic Land came out, and it was back to just looking like the 8-bit game, but now it was cartoonier looking, and same with Treasure Island, cartoonier looking, fun looking. Crystal Kingdom Dizzy on the Amiga was like, it was native to the Amiga. It was like they had finally made a 16-bit Dizzy, because the Spellbound Dizzy, the Amiga version of Spellbound, it just looked exactly like the Spectrum or C64 version, but were just like, hardly any tweaks made. They used the same sprites and everything. It was kind of gross.
Uh-huh.
So they'd obviously sort of stopped trying by that point. But yeah, Crystal Kingdom Dizzy, top quality product. But you had to have an Amiga to have it. And I didn't by this time. And eventually I did. But, And that was it. They never wanted to make a homemade feeling little Dizzy game ever again. They had this... Basically, they had ideas above their station. They had eyes bigger than their stomach. They were trying to play with the big boys. So they just... I mean, what I've done there is I've just lined up cliches. But that's kind of what they did. So they went to the Mega Drive next. And they did a port. And this was also... Actually, I think this might have been a native Amiga port. But it ran... It was like full screen on the Mega Drive, but like it had weird black bars at the sides on the Amiga, so I'm never quite convinced. I think this was a Mega Drive game. But they brought out Fantastic Dizzy on the Mega Drive, which was a conversion... Well, no, a full remake a special edition of The Fantastic Adventures of Dizzy on the NES, the one that had been a best of.
Yeah.
And they did a great job. That was a good game. That was, in the same way that Crystal Kingdom Dizzy felt native to the Amiga, this didn't quite feel native to the Mega Drive, but it wasn't miles off. You know, it felt like it belonged on a console. And it was, you know, them trying out a kind of game that console gamers hadn't played before, and they, you know, put enough polish on it that they might be interested in playing it. But they weren't. And that was it. That was the end of Dizzy. They tried all they could. It came with a really cool map, and it came with stuff, but it didn't work. And Dizzy was no more. And it was a shame. That was just... it just felt like... What happened with Dizzy felt like what happened with, I don't know, the rest of life. Which is that it was this homemade thing, like we were talking about at the start. They talked like we talked. They thought like we thought. And the jokes and the sort of the nature of it was very native to us. And then... It tried to break America, you know? It tried to go too far. It tried to take on board other people's ideas of what gaming should be, i.e. on a console. And it just couldn't compete there. And so as soon as it got there, it felt like someone who'd been, you know, the manager of a fairly successful nightclub in a little village trying to open a big nightclub in a city and just being exposed for being a little guy with with like big dreams but problems, and he's going through a divorce, and he's wearing tracksuits all the time, and
I was gonna say he was revealed to be a little egg wearing boots and boxing gloves.
Yeah, like exactly. Back home where we lived and where Dizzy lived, that was great. He was the little smiley egg guy. He was our little friend on the computers. But as soon as he tried to compete with Sonic the Hedgehog, as soon as he tried to compete with Mario himself on his home turf, it was like, no, go home. You're never going to compete on this level.
And everybody probably looked and thought, they somehow made a middle-aged Italian plumber into an international icon. Certainly it can't be that hard.
Well, genuinely they probably did. That's the kind of mindset they were working with. And their business was doing really well. Like, you know, those two kids, those twins, they were successful. You know, sports car successful.
Yeah.
And it must have been so sad for them to find out that actually... Well, actually, do you know what? I don't even know how involved they were personally. Because, you know, as I say, it had gone on... It was Big Red Software were making it now. And Codemasters owned it. And in fact, that was part of the problem. When it all fell apart, they kind of, you know, and the Oliver twins went out themselves and opened their own businesses and started making their own games. Like, Dizzy immediately couldn't happen anymore because the copyright was joint owned by two disparate businesses, Codemasters, the publisher, and the Oliver twins, the creators who coded them initially. And they were like, they weren't working together anymore. You know, I can only imagine they weren't on good terms, because otherwise they'd just signed a contract and it would have been fine. But no, that contract never got signed. And then it actually ended quite sadly, because there was a... In the era of Kickstarters, when all the big kickstarted games were happening, where like all of the classic games we all remember were... Some team or other were like, let's bring that back. We'll bring this back. And everyone kickstarted it. And these Kickstarters were making millions and they were bringing out these games. The Oliver twins showed up and they were like, great, we'll do this. And they started a Kickstarter and like, we're going to make a new Dizzy. The problem was they didn't really explain what that meant. You know, people didn't remember Dizzy anymore. And they asked for too much money. I think they asked for like £1 million for what was... supposed to feel like a little homegrown game. I think people thought the way I did. I think they were like, I don't want a AAA Dizzy. That's not what I want. And they didn't back it. And also, they didn't play the game properly. As in the Oliver twins didn't play the Kickstarter game the way other people were. So they didn't make a running demo, for instance, that you could play. Oh. They just said they'd make it. They just said, we'll make a game and here's a couple of background art that we've come up with. And like, it would have been great, and they probably weren't to know. You know, they just didn't realize what that's what you had to do to get a successful Kickstarter, because it was the early days. But it it failed hard, and it was kind of the first Kickstarter of note that failed hard. The sort that was like, well, we assume, and up till now, it looks reasonable to assume that a nostalgic-based video game-based Kickstarter will definitely succeed, and we can make a game. It was the first one of those that really failed, and that's a real shame. Since then, though, they've kind of hit their stride. They know what level they're on now, and people have been backing them to like release stuff from their attic where they've found an old unreleased game or whatever. And
yeah,
unfortunately, those games usually turn out to be. So, for example, there was this game that was going to come out called Wonderland Dizzy. And that was always going to come out. Like, we always knew that there was going to have been Wonderland Dizzy. That would have been the next big Dizzy game, but it didn't happen. And then they were like, well, we're going to release Wonderland Dizzy then. We'll do a Kickstarter. We've got it here. It's it's on a cartridge. It's on the NES. It's Wonderland Dizzy. And everybody kickstarted that. And I think the sort of people who kickstarted that were basically happy with what they got.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have been. I didn't kickstart it because I think either I had a sinking feeling or... Oh, no, I know. I just don't have any money. But when it came out, it was just Magic Land Dizzy, but with a couple of different sprites put over the top and the ability to play as girlfriend Dizzy, Daisy. And it's like, that's what I don't want. That's the same thing as, you know, re-releasing Prince of the Yoke Folk on the Game Gear with a different name. Like, it's like a new Dizzy has come out, and then you play it, and you're like, oh, it's not.
Yeah.
I was fooled. That's what it is. It's like being fooled, and that feels so corporate, and that is the opposite of Dizzy. Dizzy feels like a friend that some kids came up with, and fun is being had, you know? And that's what it is. I think when Dizzy left that world of, like, fun and entered the world of corporate business in a way that was obvious, you know, of course it always was, but in a way that was now actually like printed all over the product itself, suddenly it just felt wrong. And I mean, the Oliver twins seem like they're nice blokes. I'm not having to go at them.
Yeah.
You know, and I want them to, you know, if they could, by doing this sort of thing, make a load of money and then make a new Dizzy game, which they seem to want to do, I'd be all for that. That'd be fantastic. But yeah, it wasn't what I wanted, really. So there's been decades now of, like, you're about to get a new Dizzy game. Ah, you're not. And that goes back to the 90s, even.
Yeah.
But happy memories of Dizzy overall.
It is happy memories of Dizzy overall. I'm going to have to bring this to a close.
Yep.
We have so much material here. This is exactly what I was hoping for. This is exactly what I was looking for. Because it's that... There are these things do mean a lot. This isn't just a matter of waxing nostalgic for nostalgic sake. It's these are things that form the way we continue to look at popular culture. Obviously, you've gone on to create comics and music and videos and podcasts that are all influenced by things you had affection for, things that. That shaped you as a young man. And where can our listeners find more of your stuff?
Well, they can find me at Sonic the Comic the Podcast. That's one place, which they'll find on, you know, it's on Apple Podcasts and so on. Or they can go to stctp.wigglehe.com. Don't worry why it's called that. That's my Sonic the Comic podcast. Also, I have an animation podcast called Serious Disney, where me and Jahan Rana Singh take seriously those Disney remakes that they've been making, the live action ones. We actually like watch them all and put them through the ringer and don't just write them off as rubbish, although many of them turn out to be. But we properly, you know, really pay attention to them as pieces of filmmaking. And we compare them to the originals and talk about, you know, adjacent animated things. So that's called Serious Disney, and you'll find that in the podcasty places. And, of course, I'm on YouTube as Demon Tomato Dave, and you'll find me on Twitter as Demon Tomato Dave as well. That's where I'll, you know, advertise anything I do. But there's plenty of videos I've got on my YouTube channel for your listeners to catch up on, like the ones we've been talking about.
Well, Dave, I'm so glad we were able to make this work out.
Yeah.
And if my listeners, I mean, obviously I can be found at BerensteinBearcast.com. I'm on Twitter at BSteinBearcast, or just you can find me at P. Corey Gonzalez. That's my I'm mostly at my regular Twitter, P. Corey Gonzalez. So if you have any questions about the Berenstain Bears. Oh, and by the way, listeners, Berenstain Bears. We promised that we were going to mention the Berenstain Bears.
The Berenstain Bears.
This is the Berenstain Bears mention. And also because of Sonic the Comet, the podcast, I got deep into Mega Drive games, and of course there is a Berenstain Bears Mega Drive game that I have been playing, and is actually a pretty solid little platformer for kids, pretty fairly generic platformer, but it does have the family, and it does have Sister Bear and Brother Bear, so you know, it exists. Otherwise, once again, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been nice to be here.
And for everyone else, I will see you all next time deep in Bear Country.